Hello and welcome to the Cooler Podcast Competition podcast. In this one-off episode, we'll be hearing all the entries to last week's competition. I'm Freddie Poser, and for today only, I'm your host. This is the abridged version of this episode, presenting clips from every submission. People touched on topics from COVID-19 to the composer, Philip Glass. All of the podcasts sent in were very impressive in their own way, which made judging them incredibly difficult. But in the end, I decided to award first place to Danny, Kier and Hannah for their take on the opening of that children's classic, The Bee Movie.
According to all known laws of politics, there is no way a Lib Dem should be able to win. Its electorate are too small to get its fat little body into the Commons. The Lib Dems, of course, wins anyway, because Lib Dems don't care what humans think is impossible. Yellow aqua, yellow aqua, yellow aqua, yellow aqua. Ooh, aqua and yellow. Let's shake it up a little. Jamie, breakfast is ready.
Coming.
Ring, 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 ring.
Hang on a second. Hello?
Jamie?
Norman?
Can you believe this is happening?
I can't. I'll pick you up. Looking sharp.
Use the stairs. Your father paid good money for those.
Sorry, I'm excited.
Here's the graduate. We're very proud of you, son.
A perfect report card. All B's.
Very proud.
Ma, I got a good thing going here.
You got lint on your furs.
Ow, that's me.
Wave to us. We'll be in row 118,000.
Bye.
Jamie, I told you to stop winning in the house.
Hey, Norman.
Hey, Jamie.
Is that fuzz gel?
A little. Special day, graduation.
Never thought I'd make it.
3 days grade school. 3 days high school.
Those are awkward.
3 days college.
I'm glad I took that a day and hitchhiked around the Commons.
You did come back different.
Hi, Jamie.
Tim, growing a mustache. Looks good.
Hear about Vince?
Yeah.
You going to the funeral?
No, I'm not going.
Everybody knows, sting someone, you die.
Don't waste it on a Trotsky. Such a hothead.
I guess he could have just gotten out of the way.
I love this whole incorporating an amusement park into our day.
That's why we don't need vacations. Boy, quite a bit of pomp under the circumstances.
Well, Norman, today we are men.
We are.
Lib Dem men.
Amen.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Students, faculty, distinguished Lib Dems, please welcome Dean Buswell. Thank you. Welcome, New Commons City graduating class of 915. That concludes our ceremonies and begin your career at Whiskex Industries.
Will we pick our job today?
I heard it's just orientation.
Heads up. Here we go.
Keep your hands and joints inside the tram at all times.
Wonder what it'll be like.
A little scary.
Welcome to Whiskex, a division of Scotch Co., and part of the Scotchagon Group.
This is it.
Wow.
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 We know that you, as a Lib Dem, have worked your whole life to get to the point where you can work for your whole life. Whiskey begins when our valiant orange bookers bring the votes to the Commons. Our top secret formula is automatically colour corrected, scent adjusted, and bubble contoured into this soothing sweet syrup with this distinctive golden glow you know as whiskey.
That girl was hot.
She's my cousin.
She is?
Yes, we're all cousins.
Right, you're right.
At Whiskex, we constantly strive to improve every aspect of Lib Dem existence. These Lib Dems are stress testing a new minivan technology.
What do you think he makes?
Not enough.
Here we have our latest advancement, the Crawlman.
What does that do?
Catches that little strand of whiskey that hangs after you pour it. Saves us millions.
Can anyone work on the Crawlman?
Of course. Most Lib Dem jobs are small ones. But Lib Dems know that every small job, if it's well done, means a lot. But choose carefully, because you'll stay in the job you pick for the rest of your life.
The same job for the rest of your life? I didn't know that.
What's the difference?
We'll be happy to know that Lib Dems as a species haven't had one day off in 27 million years.
So you'll just work us to death?
We'll sure try.
That was a clip from Danny, Keir and Hannah's take on the Bee Movie. And you can catch the rest of that, along with the rest of all of these entries, in the unabridged version of this podcast, available from our website, cooler.org.uk. The rest of the entries are now presented in no particular order. Josh Newman submitted this podcast on the status of the monarchy in a modern, liberal United Kingdom. A serious and considered take on a controversial issue, this no-nonsense discussion makes a compelling case for the link between the monarchy and UK populism.
I thought this was the perfect time to reflect on the interplay between patriotism and the monarchy. So I'm not here to talk to you about the history of the monarchy or why the royals are such awful people, because I don't necessarily believe that to be true. I just want to talk today about the value of the monarchy in a liberal society, in a more fair and just society, and whether having an unelected head of state is really the framework that we want to exist within, and how we can improve on the current system to work towards a more equal society. So I thought it would be best to start looking at what exactly the monarchy is. What does it represent? And to me, as a Republican, the monarchy sends a message of worth based on birth. The idea that you as an individual, as a human being in a society, are worth fundamentally more than somebody else simply as a result of where or who you are and the family that you're born into. And that's essentially what the monarchy is. It is a system, an institution of unelected leaders who have a supposed divine right to lead, not because they have a democratic mandate, not because they are particularly necessarily good at their job, although I'm sure some of them are, but instead by virtue of their birth. And this is exactly where the problem lies. This idea that some people have more worth than others on the basis of our entrenched class system and the difficulties that we as a society face at overcoming these class divisions. This is part of the very root of the problem we have with social mobility, or, well, lack thereof, in this country. And addressing an unelected head of state who represents many of the issues that we have in this country and dismantling that system is the starting point for knocking down that entire institutionally biased class divide. And nowhere is this idea that one person is worth more than another more evident than in recruitment for the military. Historically and today, you see a bias in recruitment to lower-ranking dog's body roles in the military from working-class communities. These are communities of people who, to the establishment, are pretty disposable. They're disposable lives. They're people who have less value in society than they do or the rest of the establishment does. So recruiting these sort of bulks up your army, bulks up your military, to very little cultural and societal impact according to this political framework of class system equaling the worth of the individual. But the system doesn't work without placating the masses. You can't systematically place the burden of death and human cost onto one specific community without using a tool to manage their feelings and their expectations. And the tool that has been used in this situation is monarchical patriotism. That is patriotism that revolves around a central figurehead being an unelected monarch.
Luke and Laura have produced perhaps the most cursed podcast ever. I would describe it further, but it has to be heard to be believed.
Check. Swenson kills squirrels.
Burn the orange book.
First past the post is the best way to run elections.
Next, Joshen takes on education policy and how we as liberals should approach this topic in the United Kingdom. Joshen's entry even contains music that he composed himself.
In 1988, the national curriculum for England and Wales was introduced by the Education Reform Act. There were two main aims to this national curriculum. One, to provide students with the essential knowledge they need to become educated citizens. And two, to provide an outline on which teachers could build and develop exciting and stimulating lessons as part of a wider school curriculum. But did it really have this effect? Does it really prepare students for the real world? And is there really any incentive for teachers to use it to develop exciting and stimulating lessons? Let's start by considering the GCSE mathematics curriculum used in England and Wales. Now, if we look at the specification, I've linked to the AQA one in the show notes, they are at the heart of it, a list of things that we expect students to be able to do. We expect them to be able to simplify expressions involving sums, powers, and the laws of indices, or to be able to factorise a quadratic expression. But we have to ask ourselves, is this what we want a mathematics curriculum to do? Do we want it simply to produce a large number of people who know how to carry out a method
but not at its core. Understand why that method works, or the general framework surrounding the subject, the principles of logic, and quantitative thinking. My answer to this question is simple. Our education system should be built to ensure our population is made of people capable of critical thinking. We could see a statistic in a newspaper and have the initiative to question it. We could see a bar chart and notice how it might be designed to mislead you. We could see through the manipulative statements politicians throw away when trying to acquire our votes. This problem is exacerbated in further study of mathematics at A-level, where a seemingly endless array of integration techniques are thrown at you, along with a sprawling list of derivative formulae that you need to memorise, because you obviously can't be a functioning adult without logarithms. Most textbooks, and unfortunately most teaching of mathematics, miss the core elements of the subject, focusing more on the robotic process of plugging in numbers and writing down results. The problem doesn't stop with mathematics. English literature becomes an endless game of trivial pursuit, focused solely on how many quotes you can remember from the centuries-old Macbeth. For the new GCSEs, modern languages were simply a test of how well you can memorise your answer to a speaking or writing task. And science was a seemingly never-ending list of facts, all obviously vital to becoming a functioning human being. It's very easy to blame educators and schools for this. Of course, they design the scheme of work and plan the lessons. But when the system of education is set up around rigorous examinations, where you simply need to follow an algorithm well to succeed, who can blame them? There's no incentive to do anything different. The new GCSE curricula came close to addressing some of these issues. The new English language GCSEs were beginning to have more of a focus on critical analysis, reading it as a possible bias of an author, but it didn't go far enough. The new GCSEs in mathematics tried to add an element of problem solving, but kept over 60% of their grade, interestingly more than enough to get the equivalent of a grade A, being based on simple algorithmic processes. We can go further to change this. As Liberal Democrats, our skills wallet policy would have changed education from being an event that happened to you to a lifelong journey of learning. But it didn't address the core of the issue. We should be campaigning for major reform of the national curriculum, a vast change of the scope of assessment, changing the focus to skills, critical thinking, analysis, and not just regurgitation of facts and formulae. And only with the educated, intelligent, and productive workforce this will provide, will a post-Brexit Britain be able to survive in an increasingly technologically advanced world.
In the next clip, Sam takes on the, shall we say, unique challenge of convincing Lara that Philip Glass is not just the greatest, but also the most liberal living composer.
Welcome to the first episode of my new podcast, The Glassblower. Today, my guest is the lovely and beautiful Lara Brown.
Hello.
Hello,
Lara.
Thank you
to speak.
It's very good to hear from you. Now, the game essentially is that I am trying to convince Lara that Philip Glass, aside from, as I'm sure we all accept, being the greatest, not only living composer, but the greatest composer of all time, is also, and that was a snicker from Lara Brown, is also the most liberal composer. Now, my reasoning is a bit more complex than straightforwardly, I love liberalism and I love Philip Glass. I think actually, if we study his music and the themes conveyed in his film scores and his operas, he is very clearly a liberal composer. But Lara has an alternate theory.
My alternate theory is that I don't think Philip Glass can be categorised as particularly political, but I think the ridiculously repetitive genre of minimalism, which you're so keen on, is, if anything, alt-right.
So that's Lara's theory. that Philip Glass is actually alt-right, and that the fact that I'm so attracted to the order and repetition in his music makes me a crypto-fascist. Now, I'm going to make the case based mostly on the themes conveyed in his work. Crayana Scatsi, which was the piece of music that first drew me to the beautiful compositions of Philip Glass, is clearly an anthem for environmentalism. It is a meditation on the ways in which we harm the natural world through our own interaction with it, through our bottomless craving for energy and fuel and natural resources. Beyond that, I would say that minimalism in general is liberal. The example that springs to mind, of course, is that John Adams, ironically named after that great liberal president, wrote an opera whose main character is another great liberal president, Richard Nixon. And I'm sure we can all agree that Nixon truly is one of the greatest liberal luminaries of the 20th century. Laura, do you have any thoughts on that?
My biggest thought is that I think the most liberal thing about Philip Glass is something that you don't personally, and sort of very hawkish liberal. Like, I think his opera Waiting for the Barbarians, in which he criticises the Iraq War, is very liberal, and it's something that I think we as the Lib Dems should be keen to claim, make our anthem. But I assume that you don't think that sort of critique is the sort of liberal that you like.
It's very interesting that you touch on that, because I agree. I think the worst thing about Philip Glass by far is his pathetic, supine dovishness. The fact that he,
his most liberal piece.
The fact that he composed an opera called Satyagraha praising Mahatma Gandhi for his supine and passive method of changing politics is a great shame. The fact that he wrote an opera about Einstein, his first opera, Einstein on the Beach, celebrating Einstein as a pacifist, is also a great shame. So I suppose I agree with you.
He's clearly a pacifist. He's a pacifist who was very outspoken about the Iraq War to the point of writing music to that effect. And I think unless you can reconcile your own views on liberalism with a sort of dovish attitude to war, then you can't possibly think Philip Glass is a liberal. I think I can think Philip Glass is a liberal because I supported the Lib Dems' condemnation of the Iraq War, but you cannot.
I'm sorry, I'm not really sure why I'm even in conversation with someone who thinks that liberalism can be reconciled with dovish foreign policy. Of course, the essence of liberalism is to fight for liberalism, to extend liberalism worldwide. If you have to do that through the sword, so be it. It is possible that Philip Glass isn't very keen on my foreign policy. But liberalism is more than a foreign policy.
And last, but certainly not least, Lewis presents the satirical COVID Conversations, an imagined interview with Colonel Karl Mieler, responsible for coordinating part of Germany's response to the crisis.
Welcome to the latest in our series of COVID Conversations. Conversations with the movers and shakers at the heart of Europe and the wider world's response to coronavirus. Today, we're going to kick off with a short interview with Colonel Karl Mueller of the German Emergency Ministry. Colonel Mueller is a senior member of the German Emergency Services who is in charge of observing foreign countries' responses to COVID-19 and applying lessons he has learnt in Germany and learnt from these countries to the individual German response. Professor Mueller, it's a real pleasure to have you with us. My apologies, Colonel Mueller. It's a real pleasure to have you with us tonight. Hello, good evening. Yeah, it's good to be on this programme. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on. It's a real pleasure. Wonderful. So, Colonel Mueller, before we get into the main questioning, would you be able to talk us through your role? Really, because I've looked and we don't really have an equivalent for your role in Britain. So just talk us through what you do. Yeah, of course. My role is, I suppose it's quite simple in many ways. So obviously, Colonel Oberst Müller. My background is in emergency medicine in the German state of Saxony. So I began as a paramedic in Dresden, also part of the reserve for the Bundeswehr, the German army, hence Colonel. And since then, I've become essentially part of the German emergency response to situations. So I did several tours of duty in Afghanistan with the German army as part of military medicine. And then I came back. I was head of Saxony's emergency medical services. But now I am a senior advisor to the German government, part of the Sanitätsministerium, and generally keeping an eye both on how we work with other countries and also on how other countries are working in response to their own pandemics. So I am, as it were, the eyes and ears of the German Sanitätsministerium in our response to the crisis. And obviously, a lot of my job, I come on programs like this and I talk to journalists like you about what we're doing. And that's some of the things I want to talk about tonight, actually, the difficulties of my job in this modern age. Okay, that's wonderful. Would you be able to give us your full title, please? Because obviously, Colonel seems a little bit impersonal. Yeah, so obviously, Colonel is a very vague title, as you correctly point out. So my full title is Bundessanitätsministerium Liaison Internationale Mann. In practice, this is Bundessanitätsministerium Mann. You know, if you want to address me by my proper title, it's Bundessanitätsministerium Mann Müller. Does that work? To be honest, Colonel, no, it's, I don't think it does. It doesn't really roll off the tongue. Is there a contraction? Well, I suppose, you know, we do contract the offices in Germany, so I suppose Bundessanitätsministerium, Bundesani Miniman. That's fine. If you call me Bundesani Miniman Müller, that should work absolutely fine. Again, Colonel, I don't think we can really do that. It lacks certain gravitas, Bundesani Miniman. It just doesn't bold of you to say that I lack gravitas. I suppose there's the acronym of the ministry, if that works. Bundesani Miniman Müller becomes BDSM Mann Müller. If that works, BDSM Mann Müller. Yes, Colonel, of all the things I'm going to call you on national radio, BDSM man is not. That's not really acceptable. And who says that? I mean, I'm sorry, this is rather rich coming from a Brit. BDSM man isn't acceptable. For goodness sake, you're acting prime minister or whatever it is. He calls himself Dom Raab. In Parliament. I mean, you know, the Germans are very sexually liberated people, but for goodness sakes, there's no need for him to broadcast this. It's also very ironic. I've seen him in your House of Commons, and Dom Raab is... I look at him, and I half expect him to call Keir Starmer sir.
That was a clip from the COVID conversations, and the last of our entries. Congratulations again to Danny, Hannah, and Keir for winning. If you want to listen to the full length of every one of these entries, an unabridged version of this podcast is available from our website, cooler.org.uk. Thank you to everyone who took part. I've been your host, Freddie Poser. Thank you for listening.